Welcome to the December session of the arguments for the Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is David Arbor and I'm from Papillion. We are having these arguments this month remotely. I'm pleased to be joined by Judge Mike Pirtle from, or Chief Judge Mike Pirtle from Omaha, and Judge Francie Reedman from Gretna. Counsel, I will remind you that in your arguments that these arguments are public, and so do keep that in mind in case there's any private information that you do not wish to make public. So with that, we will take up the last remaining case of the day, which is A19-948, State versus Ramos. And Mr. Gertig, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. If I may reserve 90 seconds for rebuttal, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Jeff Gertig, and I am appearing on behalf of my client, the defendant appellant in this matter, Eric Ramos, a current inmate at Tecumseh State Correctional Institution. Laid out before you, I think, cut to the chase, the issue is whether or not the double jeopardy clause bars or prohibits the retrial or a second trial of my client, Mr. Ramos, based on a mistrial that was ordered by the District Court, Honorable Judge Vicki Johnson in the District Court of Johnson County. And to go further into the issue, to kind of drill into it, is as you can see in the briefs, not just the double jeopardy being invoked or attached, as we believe, but the question is for the court, did Mr. Ramos, did we prove the burden being on Mr. Ramos, that the state, the prosecution, intended to provoke, or I think the buzzword is goad, my client into moving for a mistrial. I think the facts and the record, and once you apply it to the law, and I'm going to refer to the factors, the seven factors in, I think, Mahonin, if I'm saying it right. But to back up and not to give a huge factual recitation, but there was a prison riot at the Tecumseh State Correctional Institution. An inmate there, Michael Galindo, was killed or murdered in the process of the riot. State charged my client, Mr. Ramos, initially with five counts. They reduced it to three. First degree murder, use of a weapon, and then we proceeded on, and also tampering with a witness, and also charged him as an habitual. We started trial on August 6th of 2018, a week into trial, August 13th, while the state was in its case in chief. There was a violation. Judge Johnson found that there was a violation of the sequestration order with respect to the state's witnesses. And based on that sequestration order violation, defense moved orally for a mistrial. Judge Vicki Johnson granted the mistrial. That was a week into the murder case on August 13th, 2018. We subsequently, the defendant filed the plea and bar at an evidentiary hearing, due to evidence with respect to the underlying circumstances and events of the mistrial, and then perfected this appeal. Before you today is a question of law, as you are well aware, calling for an independent analysis or with respect to a clearly erroneous standard with respect to whether or not it goes to the key is prosecutorial intent. And intent in this matter, while it is subjective, based on the prosecution, as far as the state is concerned, the district court can rely upon an objective analysis of the facts, inferring all the circumstances around the respect of the intent.
Is the question of intent one of fact?
Yeah, I think it has to be one of fact, because intent is that elusive measure that we try to capture, or kind of try to put smoke in the bottle. Yeah, I would say yes. It's a fact-based intent, reviewing the record and all the kind of a totality of the circumstances when you apply the seven factors. So yes, I would agree that it's a matter of intent as far as
fact. You had the burden of proof on this issue. Is that correct?
That's right. We embrace, let there be no mistake, that the law is clear that when it comes to when you bifurcate double jeopardy cases, and we're not talking about a manifest or injustice here, we're talking about provocation or goading. But yes, Your Honor, Justice, we have the burden to prove prosecutorial intent, and that's when you get into the seven-factor test of the Haunted, and I think how we go through the seven factors. So yes, to answer your question, we have the burden, which I think you'll maybe hone in real quick is one of the things that we wanted to bring to the court's attention is proving intent. We find the case law, at least our position that we would stand upon, the proposition is that it's really the prosecution as far as putting forth the intent here. Mr. Jason Bergevin, Assistant Attorney General, was the lead counsel. We didn't have any, as the record is clear, no testimony from any prosecution, prosecutor, and no affidavits. So we were having to...
Could have you called him as a witness?
Yes. And I expected that question. And I think Judge Vicki Johnson also said, you know, could you have subpoenaed lead counsel? We could have. We did not. We expected that lead counsel of the case would be at the evidentiary hearing. He was not. But to answer your question, yes, we could have subpoenaed. We did not. We expected him to be there. And short of him not being there, the state put on evidence through Investigator Trantham and some other law enforcement. So, yeah.
When you got to the hearing and saw that he wasn't there, did you move for a continuance at that time?
No, we did not. We proceeded to go forward without the subpoena. Again, it was a strategical decision that we made to go forward as far as going forward and not moving for a continuance. We were ready to go on putting forth the evidence that day and stating our issue of the case. So, yes. And that was Vicki Johnson. Judge Johnson also pointed that out in her order as well. And I understand that may or may not be a critical factor as we go forward, because we do have the burden, and I embrace that burden. I know I understand it. So yes,
Mr. Gehrig, I'd like you to address the issue with respect to the continual discovery that was provided up until right before trial, and I guess my question about that is it seems to me that your argument is at some point the state had to quit investigating and just stand on what they had. And, what is your authority for that position? And if I'm misstating your position, please correct me.
No, I think, and I think that goes to, thank you, Your Honor. I think that goes to the first prong, whether there was the sequence of the overreaching or error, prior errors resulting in the ultimate mistrial is probably one of the factors. The authority that we look upon is, as I mentioned in a brief, it wasn't just a spur of the moment kind of ad hominem breakdown, if you will, during the trial. There was a continual pattern of discovery violations. The authority was the discovery order of Judge Johnson back in February. And as indicated in the record that, you know, there was repeated violations of the discovery and up to the point of trial where Judge Johnson had to call out the prison officials. And that's something that we wanted to talk about was, you know, it seems that there is this disconnect between the state's actors and agents in this case from the prosecution when we believe it's all, you know, the state is the state and the state's responsible for the actions of the prison. Be that as it may, Your Honor, the authority is the repeated violations where we continually had to file motions to compel or for sanctions. And to Judge Johnson, I think the record is clear about her frustration through the process as far as, I think that's what led to the ultimate mistrial was one of the critical factors that she mentioned was the continued discovery violations. And so that goes to prong one, Your Honor, as far as getting to the overreaching or error, the pattern that led to the ultimate mistrial.
Were the discovery violations just the delay in getting the information to you and then the incident where some information was redacted?
Delay, and then I think, yes, Justice, plus if you look at the claimed informer, claiming the informer, the cloak or the protection of the informer It was an actually withholding of, it was an actual withholding of the, of what we believe would be Brady or exculpatory material. So it was just a combination of not just the delay, but what we kind of refer to as rolling or piecemeal discovery or kind of a hide the ball. And again, when you get into prosecutorial intent, I try to not go take shots below the belt, but you got to go towards how do you prove the intent when it comes to, and you have to look at the pattern. And so I see that I'm maybe still losing a little time. I want to reserve a little time, but I'll ask or answer any questions that I may.
Any further questions at this time?
No, thank you.
All right, we'll reserve the rest of your time. Ms. Faust.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Stacey Faust. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the Appalachian, the state of Nebraska. In order to succeed in this appeal, most must show that the district court clearly erred in finding that the state did not intend to goad or provoke Ramos into moving for a mistrial, and he cannot meet his burden. According to Ramos's arguments, there really are two underlying issues in this case. One, the late discovery, and two, Investigator Trantham meeting with Corporal De Los Santos at the direction of the prosecution to find 7 minutes of what really was irrelevant missing video surveillance.
Was that a violation of the sequestration order?
Not technically. The court called it a violation of the spirit of the sequestration order. She never specified that they couldn't discuss the trial with each other. It was, I guess, just a general sequestration order. You can't be in the courtroom when each other are testifying, but it's a violation of the spirit of sequestration, she called it. Evidence that the state intended to provoke or goad Ramos into moving for mistrial, however. One of the factors to consider in a plea and bar case such as this is whether the state committed a sequence of overreaching or error prior to the errors involving the mistrial. Ramos argues that the sequence here was the multiple discovery violations, but the court rejected that argument. The court found that the state's untimely disclosures were not because it wanted to goad Ramos into moving for a mistrial, but rather because of, quote, poor planning at the front end, complicated by a massive flood of data at the trail end. I don't know that it was necessarily poor planning. What I do know is that there was a massive flood of data, and not just at the tail end. The complexity of the crime scene and the nature of the crime are important here. Ramos is charged with the murder of Michael Galindo, but this is really a double homicide case. And the crime scene was extensive. The amount of property damage made it hard for law enforcement to tell what pieces were evidence and what pieces weren't. The crime scene was infected with fire damage, water damage, smoke damage. Other than hours and hours upon painstaking video surveillance, the eyewitnesses, there should have been witnesses were inmates who weren't going to cooperate for obvious reasons. By February 21st, which was the discovery deadline, the state had disclosed to the defense over 20,000 pages of discovery. It then continued to provide the defense with discovery mostly as it received it or as the court ordered based upon the sensitive discovery matters.
Could the state have alleviated some of this by waiting to file charges against the defendant?
At one point, Judge Johnson commented, I think it's really ever his dispute, that the charges were filed because Ramos either jam out date or parole is coming up, was coming up at the time. So that's why they filed.
Okay, thank you.
Honestly, I don't think there's anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. At the end of the day with the discovery, there was no intent to cause a mistrial. The state was merely dealing with the hand that it was dealt, and therefore Ramos fails on this factor. The remaining factors to consider concern the circumstances surrounding the mistrial. Ramos does not dispute that the prosecutor resisted the mistrial. And we know from the state's arguments, both in opposition to the mistrial, as well as at the plea and bar hearing, and with the witness testimony at the plea and bar hearing, why the prosecutor instructed Investigator Trantham to meet with Corporal De Los Santos to find that missing video. And it was in response to the defense's opening statement that there was huge gaps in the video surveillance when that wasn't true. And so the prosecutor asked Investigator Trantham to try one last-ditch effort, go find this, to rebut that false accusation. The district court.
Does that violate the discovery order, the discovery cutoff order?
Well, I mean, all discovery was supposed to be in by February 21st. I just think in a case of this magnitude, that just wasn't realistic, and it would happen with the voluminous information in this case and the fact that there's nothing wrong with the fact that the investigation was ongoing. It was a case, an extensive crime scene. And so.
Well, who should bear the risk of the possibility then of all evidence not being admissible at trial? A defendant who has a right to a speedy trial, or the state who's trying to gather all of the evidence in order to prosecute its case? I mean, they seem to be a little conflicting here.
Well, ultimately, with the 7 missing minutes was irrelevant. The defense had all of the video from the attack for months. I mean, that was the relevant video. And when it comes to discovery versus getting your right to a speedy trial, it's a choice the defendant has to make. He just does. And in this case, he didn't request a continuance. He opted to proceed with trial.
With the expectation maybe of the court enforcing a discovery deadline and barring the state from offering that late evidence. Right?
She absolutely could have. In fact, I think that that's probably what should have happened here instead of the mistrial. I think if it would have been delved into further at that time, it would have been revealed that this surveillance meant nothing. It did nothing. And his discovery was during Major Connolly's testimony. And all he did was help them get into the system in order to find it. And they didn't discuss trial testimony. At most, all they talked about was Major Connolly's frustration with the defense at his own credibility on an unrelated matter. So I hope I answered your question.
Thank you.
The district court found that the timing of the error weighed slightly in favor of Ramos, but the little evidence on the record indicated that the state was confident in the guilty verdict, but that the missing video could be used at a second trial by the state to rebut the defense's shoddy investigation theory. Frankly, the defense's theory didn't blow up just because surveillance video was found. As I said, it didn't mean anything. The defense's entire case up until the mistrial was attacking all of the witnesses on exactly that, the shoddy investigation, and on attacking the initial missing video surveillance and its alleged editing of it. In other words, the defense's attack of the state's case on the shoddy investigation theory did not hint on that missing video. And even if the state could use it, it was still going to have to address that theory, because that was always the defense's theory and it didn't change just because that video was found. But I think most importantly, the timing of the error actually weighed in favor of the state. As Ramos argues, and as the state has always maintained, the video surveillance of the actual attack and the testimony of Trantham and De Los Santos tracking Ramos as one of the assailants was the state's case. It makes absolutely no sense for the state, after all of the discovery, after all of the contentious battles with defense counsel, after all of the hard work, would intend to cause a mistrial before it presented its best evidence of Ramos's guilt.
Why wasn't lead counsel at the hearing?
Well, it's not part of the record, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
It's not part of the record.
Okay, thank you.
There was zero motivation. No way on these facts did the state want to do this a second time. or risk not obtaining a conviction. With that, if there are no further questions.
Are there any other questions, judges?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Faust. How much time do we have left for Mr. Gertig then?
45 seconds, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Gertig, go ahead.
Well, thank you. I'll just get to the point. Either it's important or it's not. Either the 7 minutes are relevant or not relevant. If it's so trivial and irrelevant as the state would like you to believe, then why are we doing it in the middle of the trial? The reason is because I think it shows that the state knew that they had a problem. We were attacking the shoddy investigation, the missing video, and we believe we were catching traction with that. The state was in its case in chief. There was no evidence of my client's guilt at that point in the record. They haven't even touched my client when it comes to his guilt or innocence. They go and they make a desperate attempt to find the 7 minutes, and now they want to walk away and say it wasn't that big deal. If it's not that big of a deal, why are we continuing to dig a hole when we're in an investigative hole when we're in the trial? You can't have it both ways. Respectfully, the state can't have it both ways. And these continuing violations up to the point of the discovery, either discovery orders or their guidelines. If we're going to go forward at their guidelines, then let's just make sure that the bar knows that these are just guidelines and we don't have to follow discovery orders so that defendants can know how to approach their right to a fair trial, speedy trial, and those type of issues. The state to the way of this, there's no statute of limitations. They're the ones that lit the candle.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gertig. The case will be taken under submission, and counsel, we thank you for your arguments. You are excused.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.